and welcome to the Moonshine Jesus Show. We thank you for joining us for today's episode, where we'll be talking about the movie IF, which is an acronym for Imaginary Friends. And I also have a friend here with me. He's just not imaginary. Please join me. How are you, sir?
That are you sure I'm really here, Mark?
That's because true.
You
I'm
know,
not sure I've ever been with you when someone else was also talking to you.
To me? Oh,
something to consider. I don't know.
Yes,
don't know.
We'll have to have those listening confirm. Can you hear
confirm
me?
Confirm one way.
Am I really
other?
Here?
Do you yeah. see him, or is it just me talking to an empty box? I don't know. I do have a very developed imagination, sometimes for the good and sometimes for the bad. We'll see. So listen, I do want to bring up that we are sponsored by ProgressiveChristianity.org. It is an absolutely fantastic place for all of your progressive Christian needs in terms of resources. We highly encourage you to go check them out. There's a newsletter you can sign up for. It's more than worth it. Also, don't forget to be following the Moonshine Jesus Show. Our Facebook page is one place to follow us. And then, of course, any place that you get your podcast, make sure that you're signed up to receive these as soon as they're available for download. And finally, and the most important, particularly in a movie like this that does have a twist in it, there will be spoilers. There'll be spoilers ahead. There's no way we're not going to spoil stuff. We have a lot of fun talking about it. And we have a lot of fun spoiling it too. So, before we dive too far in, we do need to make sure that we have appropriate beverages for the duration of the show. So I'm curious, what did you decide to go with?
So one of the themes of this movie is about embracing childhood and imagination. And I thought, what drink makes me think of my childhood? And I thought, you know what? It's Kool-Aid. Kool-Aid is a drink of my childhood. I grew up in the 90s and Kool-Aid was a staple. And so I've got a spiked Kool-Aid. So just red Kool-Aid and vodka here. That's what I'm drinking. How about you, Mark? Yeah.
Well, I tried to use my imagination and make something up. I think everyone who watched the film really enjoyed the character Blue, who is this very large purple imaginary friend. The joke is that his kid was colorblind, which really isn't a great joke because that's not really how colorblindness works, but that's fine. So I tried to make, a purple drink. I'm calling it the blue bourbon. I'm calling it a blue bourbon fizz. It's got bourbon. It's got blue curacao. It's got grenadine, little ginger ale, and a little bit of club soda for the fizz part. It came out really dark purple. You can't really tell.
Oh, yeah. Purple, almost black.
It's almost black. So, you know, hey, you put your imagination out there, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But that's what I'm still calling it anyway. I'm calling it the Blue Bourbon Fizz in honor of Blue in the movie. So,
cheers.
Cheers, sir. And it's not bad at all. All right. We're going to take a quick drop here and we will catch you all on the other side of it.
Moonshine Jesus. Moonshine Jesus.
Hello, and welcome back to the Moonshine Jesus Show, where today we're talking about IF, Imaginary Friends, and we are moving into our geeking out section, where Mark and I will be geeks about the movie for a little bit, and then we'll move into the theology and politics of the show. So if you haven't seen IF, it is a movie with a star-studded cast about imaginary friends and what happens to them. When their kids forget about them. Isn't that the way kids growing up forgetting about their imaginary friends? It's framed through the heartbreaking story of Bee, who loses her mom to cancer and finds herself re-embracing the world of fantasy when her dad has to have heart surgery at the same hospital where her mom died. So, Mark, I feel like maybe a great place to start with this is just by asking you, Did you ever have an imaginary friend when you were growing up?
You know, I really did not. Unless, of course, I've just grown up too much and forgotten about
it. And forgotten. Yeah.
So I, that's a distinct possibility. But to the best of my recollection, I didn't have an imaginary friend. I was a very, as I remember, imaginative kid. I had worlds that I would create in my, like, the carport at the house and all kinds of things. But I don't recall ever having an imaginary friend that I talked to. How about you? Did you have an imaginary friend?
You know, I actually, very similarly, I had a huge imagination. I was an only child for the first 10 years of my life. So my younger brother is 10 years younger than I am. So I played by myself a lot when I was growing up and had imagination, but I don't ever remember having an imaginary friend. I did go see this though with my daughter, and she created an imaginary friend as we were watching the movie.
Wow. Now and that is cool.
I had an imaginary friend named Snowball the cat who watched this movie with me. And Snowball's magical power is that if you Snowball sits on your head, you get a brain freeze. And I learned about that as I was watching this movie with my 8-year-old. Don't you love it?
I absolutely do. That's fantastic.
Imagination coming to life in the middle of the show.
Right
okay.
In the middle.
That's so, Mark,
I absolutely love it.
Here's the thing about this movie. It's got a bit of a mixed reception. And so we've seen this a whole lot lately where critics and audiences are really divided. And we've talked about why that is a lot.
Yeah.
But here's what the critics say. They say, hey, the story is a little light and the plot's a little underdeveloped. There are some tonal shifts that feel a little stark. But the audiences say that this is heartwarming and fun. And so I'm curious, Mark, where do you land on this? How did you receive the movie?
Well, first, I agree with both of them. I think both of those are very true. I loved the movie. It felt like a 1980s, the Amblin type films, E.T. and those kinds of things. It just had that look. It had the heart first, jokes second kind of thing that happens in those types of films. The score felt like a 1980s, like emotional kids film. There were definitely shifts and they were sort of weird at times. It would go from family building to scary drama to there was very cartoony. There were certainly shifts that didn't feel they didn't feel seamless. It felt like it was a very quick start and stop.
Yeah.
Anyway, how about you? What was your experience? I will also say there were two different times where I would just have my glasses off and just wiping the tears out of my, just so I could keep seeing what was on the screen.
It got me too. It was heartwarming in kind of an unexpected way for me. Mm-hmm. And I totally didn't expect to tear up at this movie, but I did tear up at this movie. And that was unexpected for me.
Yeah.
I think the part that was hard for me was that it felt like maybe some of the story was a little underdeveloped, it has a twist, but I feel like a twist that's broadcast pretty clearly early on, so I felt like and here we go, spoiler alert, I felt like Cal, the neighbor who is really Bee's imaginary friend, I felt like that was pretty clear early on. I mean, as you alluded to earlier, Mark, he wasn't speaking to any other human being. That's a telltale sign that maybe that person's not really there. We get the clue that he had been a clown. And it seems to make sense. And so I kept looking at my daughter, wondering if she understood what was going on. And she didn't get it. It went over her head.
All right.
So it hit
younger generations maybe
differently.
Who haven't, like us, spent every week, year after year, dissecting movies and understanding how they work.
Yeah.
Like to a kid who's just there to enjoy it, maybe it paid off.
Maybe it paid off. And I mean, maybe that's what I'm getting at about like the thing about the differences between critics and audiences is that like, maybe it's okay to kind of turn that off for a little bit and to just enjoy the movie. And while I think I would have liked to have known more about like the imaginary friends, like how they were created and what happens whenever they rejoin their kids and stuff. I felt like they fell really short.
Like this would be a very easy movie to criticize if you were just of the mindset that I want to be critical. But it's just such a fun, enjoyable movie.
One of the things that
even as I was just saying, hey, I'm just going to enjoy this thing. Mm-hmm. One of the things that really got to me was that when they shifted from getting trying to find new kids for the imaginary friends to reconnecting the imaginary friends with their adults, we really didn't get any payoff the moment they connected. There wasn't any kind of where does this go from here? How does that impact their lives? What does it change? You know, and I felt like we needed that.
Yeah. And so I was curious what you thought about that in particular, because that was one of the things that I was really left wondering at the end of the movie is what is it exactly that is happening when people are reuniting with their ifs? Is it just embracing the comfort from nostalgia, like a feeling of comfort and confidence that an imaginary friend gives you? Or is it something else? I mean, can they see the imaginary friend? Is that imaginary friend going to be with them? What do you think is happening when they rejoin?
I think within the framework of what the movie seems to be trying to do is that it's reconnecting them with a part of themselves that was there as a child. Mm-hmm. And it's probably different to some degree for each person about what that imaginary friend's purpose was, because they can come about for all kinds of different reasons. And at least the ones that we saw, reconnecting with them helped the person kind of become, I'm going to say, confident, joyful, like kind of reestablish themselves, being able to reconnect with that piece that was missing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I kind of feel like it was leaning towards that, but they certainly didn't tell us, right?
They did not tell us, and they kind of left that open to interpretation. I mean, maybe that was their purpose to make us think, did I have an imaginary friend? And what was that like for me? And kind of lean into that nostalgia. You know, Majin is watching live and has lifted up that Wonder Woman was his imaginary friend who served as a protector. And I think that is very interesting to go back and think about what games we played as kids. And if we were playing by ourselves or with others, who it is that we brought into there kind of in a fictional environment, the world building we did in our head, as you said, Mark. Hey, one of the things that stood out for me, and I'm curious what stood out for you was cinematography was a real highlight of this film for me, because the way that they did this just kind of made this feel like this magical film fantastical place. And I think particularly whenever we were like on the stairs, the shot of the stairs.
That was amazing, right?
An amazing shot. And the first time we see those stairs are, you know, very early in the movie, and we see her kind of ascend up to this place and we see the light at the top of the stairs is kind of and then she goes and stands on top of the light, and it's kind of like this the symbolism for what's happening. And so I thought that was done very well, and the cinematography in this was just beautiful. That was a highlight for me. Did you have highlights, Mark, of things that
there were really several things. The cinematography, as I understand it, the cinematographer is like Steven Spielberg's go-to cinematographer. So it's not surprising that it had this really kind of beautiful, perfect framing, lots of light play that goes on that he's kind of known for. I also loved the soundtrack. The other two things I'm going to name are stuff that I have heard that people really complained about. That the
there
was too much music and it was too frequently forecasting or foreshadowing what was going to happen. It was a little overly dramatic. It just felt, like I said, this whole movie felt like an Amblin 80s film to me. And the music, I thought, nailed that feel. Like, it's, it was intentional to feel that way. And then the other thing was, there's some of the dialogue that I absolutely loved that was just pure cheesiness.
Yeah.
But it was just like early on when B's talking to her dad, dad says, she says to dad, life doesn't always have to be fun. And he gets that kind of twinkle in his eye and a little sly smile. And he says, that doesn't stop us from trying. Now, that's a cheesy line. It's so silly. But that the kid in me was yelling, like, you know, it's like, that's right. We need to keep trying, kind of thing. And so, yeah, those were kind of, because I know the movie's getting hit really hard on the writing in particular. And there are times where I completely get it. But the part about it being a little overly cheesy, again, I think it was supposed to be. It's kind of made it fun.
Right. I agree with you. And especially about the music. It didn't hurt that one of the anchor songs was Tina Turner. And I thought that that was a lot of fun. I mean, we were.
That was.
And again, I the purpose of this is kind of a family film. Right. And so I did go see it with my daughter. And so we were like dancing in the seats. We were jamming out and we had a good time. And so I think that that was one of the purposes here.
Yeah.
No doubt. Mark, before we end the segment, I want to ask you a question about this. Yeah. I want to know what you think the main point of the film was. Why? What was the film trying to accomplish here?
I think the main point of the film was simply that we allow the difficulties in life to become so important to us that we forget the joys. And that our kid, as kids, were very good at connecting with those joys.
Yeah.
Sort of what I think it was. Where did you end up with what you thought they were trying to tell us?
Yeah, I think there's certainly that going on. And I think also it's how we overcome difficulties and the ways that we are able to cope in difficult situations and the need for community and support. And I think certainly here with a young girl who doesn't have it finds it through her imagination. But I think that that's ultimately a human longing, no matter what our age, that we want friends, you know, we want community and we need that as human beings in order to not just survive, but to thrive in life. And so I like that point of the movie and and ultimately I really enjoyed this. I thought it was a lot of fun.
I did too. I had the best. It was so weird. My wife and I went together and we don't always go to the sci-fi fantasy kind of, isn't always, depends on what it is, whether she likes it or not. I thought it was going to be great. We went on a Saturday morning at 11 o'clock. I assumed it was just going to be wall-to-wall kids and we'd get to hear the reactions. And it was just the two of us in the theater.
Nobody theater to yourself.
Yeah, we had the whole theater, but it was fun. It was neat to see, and both of us were just, you know, in tears at several places, and it was just such a joy. It was a joyful experience. Like it reconnected you in some ways to joy, which is part of, I think, what was going on, right?
Yeah, I think so, and I mean that's part of entertainment. Anyway, I mean, if we can't find some joy and escapism in movies, I mean, ultimately, are they serving their purpose? So, hey, I would love to talk about this more, but there's also a lot of theology and political themes in this movie. So why don't we take a quick break, come back after the drop and talk about theology and politics.
Hello, Hello and welcome back to the Moonshine Jesus Show. You're joining us for what's normally titled our Theo Politico segment. I think I'm going to retitle it to Theo Psychologico, maybe.
Okay.
This time.
Okay.
I think a lot of the questions that we're going to talk about, that I'd like us to talk about, has a lot to do with our psychology and the way we form ourselves, the way we see the world, and the way the world influences us. So, right at the top of the movie, one of the lines that is getting panned a lot, which I really appreciated, was the main character saying, "The most important stories we have to tell are the ones we tell ourselves." I'm curious how that line hit you, and do you, is there truth in that for you, or is it naive, or just kind of your general feeling about what's going on there?
I think there is truth in that, you know, the way that we make sense of situations is important, and everybody does this to an extent, right? We all see the world through our own lens, and then we interpret what is happening. And so I think the way being aware of that is one of the things that we ought to be doing at this point in time. And I think one of the cultural moves we've been trying to get better at is to say, hey, look, maybe there's not kind of this universal way of seeing things, but maybe instead everything that we see is filtered through our own individual experience. And so I think one of the ways that I think that comes through pretty clearly is in terms of race, right? Because because I think that white America had this tendency, and still does, to universalize experience and say, well, 100%. All people are pretty much the same. You know, we've all kind of got this experience. I'm colorblind. I don't see race. And I think one of the things that we've been trying to do better at is to say, actually, you know what? We all have different experiences, and our experiences kind of color the way that we see the world. Yeah, and so I think being aware of the stories that we tell ourselves is important. Yeah. And I think that that telling ourselves more helpful stories as time goes on is important as well, being aware of how that is influencing our lives. My initial thoughts on that, what do you think?
Yeah. No, I think it is a really important line. It actually indirectly sets up the whole imaginary friends. I mean, imaginary friends frequently are developed out of a child's internal monologue, the thoughts and things that they're thinking. A friend will all of a sudden become that internal, an imaginary friend will all of a sudden become that internal monologue. And I think, you know, a lot of our development as human beings happens in internal dialogues. They say that we spend about 25% of our lives in an internal dialogue. So it's very important in how it forms us and how we understand ourselves. The Tao Te Ching says that understanding other people is intelligence. Understanding yourself is wisdom. So internal monologue really becomes so important. And I think it's not what's important about it is what you're telling yourself in that story, in that internal monologue. Are you beating yourself up? Are you saying that you're doing dumb things, that you should be doing it better? Are you trying to process it and analyze it and recognize that there's room for improvement, but that you were doing your best? And so I think what's mostly important isn't just the stories that we tell ourselves, but what we allow those stories to tell us about ourselves.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, because we can have real negative stories about ourselves, or, you know, I think people can also get real hung up on mistakes and kind of, well, what if I had done this or what if I had done that? And, you know, in this situation, I really should have acted differently or whatever. And, and maybe we should have, but the fact is we didn't. And, and, you know, beating yourself up about that kind of stuff does almost no good at all. And so you're right. Like, telling ourselves a different kind of story can reframe. I think that's one of the things a lot of people learn in therapy, you know, is that, like, it is important that we kind of change our narrative, is that we are having kind of affirming narratives, and that we are trying to change the way we see ourselves internally And so, yeah, I think you're right. I think that's important.
Absolutely. So I love that they opened it up with that, and that it does reflect into the fact that a lot of imaginary friends is sort of like an embodiment of that internal dialogue. And I love that they did that. So we've talked a bit about this already, about how the show in part is about adults trying to hold on to that kind of childlike joy or whatever you want to, a matter of fact, twice, the father figure in this is doing something goofy and childlike. And one character, I think it was once his daughter and once it's the nurse, that says, "You've got to stop, you know, doing those kind of ridiculous, silly things." And
right. He
gives this little smile again and says, "Never." I'm wondering, I always felt when the times that happened, that again, the internal kid was just cheering that on, like, "Yeah, do it, love it." Talk a little bit about what you see or maybe don't see. Is there an importance to not letting go of that childlike joy, that sort of general wonder of the world around us? Is that, how important is it, and to what degree and level do you think that's something we should be trying to actively do?
Yeah, I think a lot of times, I think we believe that we, as we grow up, need to let go, need to become more serious about things. And I get it. But I think that also being able to embrace the joy of life is something that's significant. And it's important, actually, for us to actually live happy lives, to allow ourselves to have fun and experience joy. And there's fun in goofiness too. And so I think this is something certainly that all of us in our lives maybe could do a better job of embracing. But also, I think churches are a place that are so profoundly guilty of this. I remember I was in a meeting once with this guy who is kind of old, white, and stodgy, talking about how the purpose of worship was to be reverent. And if anyone wasn't reverent, they weren't really worshiping. And he kind of had that whole thing. I'm like, this guy is so devoid of any joy that you're supposed to experience in worship. And so I think that even the church certainly ought to deal with important issues and all, but also ought to be a place where we can learn to experience joy.
I want to come back to that. And I agree. I think it's very important that we hold on to it. I mean, life is hard, man. I don't know if you've noticed, but life is really tough.
I'm
sorry. I hate that I planted that seed. I don't know if you'll ever be the same again.
I hope that doesn't grow.
But if you don't allow yourself those spaces of that childlike joy and this sort of wonder of the world around us, then the chaos of the world, and I don't like using that because chaos is actually really great and creative in its own way. Mm-hmm. But the kind of the dangers of the world and the negativities of the world and the things that can be depressing will just, they'll eat you up. They'll eat you alive.
Yeah.
Having that childlike joy that's able to sort of at least temporarily separate those realities away from who you are in the moment and be able to experience that deep joy that we kind of energizes us and reestablishes us, I think is really, really important.
You know, Mark, you also said about wonder. And I think that's significant too, that and different from joy, but like the curiosity of children wondering about things. I think that's something also that we lose. And I think you're 100% right to point that out, because the wonder, I think, helps us to more fully engage with the world and to not think that we've got it all figured out. And so I think that's particularly important in religion as well. Like we want like a set of beliefs, and we lose the ability to wonder and to be amazed.
And that's where I want to go. We've got a couple more minutes left in this segment. Yeah. Kind of want to explore that. So what kinds of things it's a two-part question. What kinds of things can the church do to help us hold on to that childlike joy of life? And are there things that the church does that distance us from that, that we might need to reconsider what we're doing.
Yes and yes. I mean, I think one thing that the church can do is to model that the church can be joyful and that it can be fun to be there and to be in community and all, because, you know, if you survey people as to why they're even at church, a lot of them are there for community building more than anything else.
Absolutely.
And so if we want to build community, I mean, it's hard to build community in places that are stodgy and are not fun. And so I think that if churches can be joyful places that encourage people to come like as they actually are, so like to stop putting on the fronts that we think we need to put on to be the nicest people we can be, so we can come sing nice hymns with nice people for an hour a week and then go. I think if we stop that narrative and we say, hey, just come as you are and let's be together as we really are, I think that helps a whole lot. And I think, yeah, there are certainly things that churches do that prohibit that. And in part, a lot of that becomes rules that churches create, and they want you to follow either in terms of ridiculous behavior guidelines or things that you have to believe, or even like etiquette and how you have to be in the physical space. Yeah. I remember when I was a kid, I was growing up in church, and I remember the kids were kind of running around church, and there's this guy who...
Not in the sanctuary, were they? They weren't running in the sanctuary, were they?
It wasn't even in the sanctuary. It was like the education wing or something, and there's this guy who's like, you can't run in church. You can't run in church. And so, like, I don't think at the church I serve... I don't think there's ever been anything like that with kids. Like, they're like, look at these kids being kids. And if kids are loud, I always stop the service when kids are loud. And I always say, isn't this wonderful that we can hear these children? You know how many churches wish they had children? And we do. Isn't that great? And I'll have the congregation stop and applaud the children.
Quit being your bragging.
I'm just saying. I'm with you. That, like, if churches embrace it, it changes everything. Absolutely everything.
Absolutely.
So I wish more churches would just embrace it.
Absolutely. I agree with you. And I'm not even going to expand on your answer, because I think I agree with everything on what the church could be doing to help connect. But also, I do think that's probably the main thing. The rules and the dogma that we get so tied into really, really does separate us from that childlike joyfulness that we should experience where we're in church. So listen, I had several more questions, but we're running out of time, and we don't want to miss our favorite segment, the Make Me Look Stupid segment. So we're going to have a quick drop, and we'll be back on the other side.
Hey, and welcome back to the Moonshine Jesus Show. We're entering our final segment, the Make Me Look Stupid segment, where we take a few moments and we think about how we really can try to make our co-host look stupid. Sometimes we make ourselves look stupid in the process. Sometimes we just chat about questions that we've got. And so, Mark, I will be the benevolent co-host today, and I will let you ask your question first.
Interesting. I have three of them. I've got to decide which one I'm most wanting.
Never mind.
No, I won't ask you all three. I'm just going to decide which one I most want your response on.
Okay.
I guess they each have a different purpose. Here's my bit. How about this one? Do you think that any of the ifs, the imaginary friends, are based on the writer, director, producer, John Krasinski's, his own childhood imaginary friend? Do you think that any of them were his? And if so, which one would it be?
Well, let's see. The I didn't think about that as I was watching it, but maybe the one who ended up actually being his imaginary friend in the show. So we find out that his character's imaginary friend is Keith, the invisible silent one, who he trips over. So maybe that's the one. Maybe he had an invisible silent imaginary friend.
His line is, what kind of kid imagines an invisible
that was here. And Brad Pitt is credited as that character.
So perfect. Because of the way Brad Pitt gets credited in one of the Deadpool movies as an invisible character. It was brilliant. Yeah. That he got credited as that. You know, I actually know the answer to this. This is part of why I asked the question.
Okay, tell me.
No, he did have a childhood friend, invisible friend, not in it. His invisible friend was, I don't remember the first name, the last name was braces, because he always wanted braces. He thought that would be cool until he got braces and he learned he did. And he was a vampire. He was a vampire.
So that wasn't it. That character wasn't in the movie, right?
Wasn't in it. But you know what was in the movie?
What?
He has two girls. And both of their imaginary friends were in the movie. You want to guess which two of the imaginary friends were his actual kids? And they helped create it and what it would look like.
Was Blue one of them?
No. Surprisingly.
How about Uni? Was Uni one?
Is played by his wife. It's voiced by Krasinski's wife.
Okay.
So I probably would have guessed that just because. You know, mom,
I'm thinking about my I've got girls. They love unicorns, and we've even got stuffed animals named Uni. So that was my line of thinking. Tell me, I don't know.
The first one, if you had thought a little longer, you might have guessed that a girl would have. It was a pink alligator. Remember the pink alligator?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
That was one of them. This one, I couldn't believe, but it's true. The other one was the marshmallow that was on fire. One of his girl's imaginary friends. He said that she's very compassionate, and that one time they were roasting marshmallows and hers caught on fire and she felt horrible about it, so she created an imaginary friend almost like the I guess give life back to this marshmallow that she burned up. So not his, but his two kids' imaginary friends were in it, and he had them be a part of creating them and what they would look like and the whole thing. So kind of cool.
I really love that, and I didn't know that, so I'm glad to find that out. Mark, I should also say that one of our live listeners has called us doofuses, and
muddle-headed doofuses.
Muddle-headed doofuses, but you know what? Like, I'm from Missouri, and a doofus is that's like a loving insult we use in Missouri, and so I actually embrace that. I'm fine with a doofus. I'm fine with it.
No problem at all.
Okay, Mark, I've got a question for you.
All right.
So Cal, Ryan Reynolds' character, is talking to Bea, and she's feeling kind of lonely, and he says, "You're never really alone. I thought that was clear by now." And I'm curious, applying that to religion, is that true, and how does that relate to religion?
Well, related to religion, it is true. You never really are alone. In terms of how I understand God, it's part of the connective tissue that connects us all, and that we all are intimately connected and related. But that doesn't mean that there aren't moments in life where you lose sight of that connectedness and you feel profoundly alone. And it's certainly one of the jobs of the church to help us all think through the reality of how connected we are and how we really are never alone, but also the tools and skill sets to remind ourselves of it when we are feeling particularly alone and isolated. So I think it's a very important piece of what good religion should do. What were your thoughts?
I agree that I think God is always with us, but I think one of the ways we know that God is always with us is through the presence of others and through community. Sure. And I think that one of the reasons that people often feel kind of abandoned by God is because they're actually abandoned by community, that of folks who don't fully want to care for others, or who care more about some of the things that we were talking about earlier, like putting up facades, and
or they're just coming from a very judgmental point of view, and they marginalize a person because of their own personal judgments.
That's right. And that can feel a lot like being abandoned by God. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, if someone is kicked out of a faith community because of sexual orientation or gender identity, for instance, that can feel a lot like, especially if we equate God with the church, that God has abandoned us, when really what it is people doing a shitty job of living into the call to love others in the way that Jesus taught us to.
It can feel like God has abandoned you, but in a lot of ways, it's that some other people have abandoned God.
That's right. Oh, I like that. I like that, Mark. That'll preach.
That'll preach a little. You preach that a little bit for sure.
Yes. Woo! I like that. Okay. Hey, Mark, this has been fun. I've really enjoyed talking about If. This was a fun movie. And I gotta admit, I think the critics are wrong about this. I think audiences are largely right. I think it's a fun movie. If you haven't seen it and we haven't sufficiently ruined it for you, I think you should go and you should go and enjoy that movie. But Mark, we've got to figure out what we're going to talk about next week. And you had an idea.
Yeah,
of something I'm hoping that we should talk about.
Yeah, and you seem to be game here. One of my favorite sci-fi fantasies of all time. It's Doctor Who. They just came out with the first three. Then they have a fourth one that they've added, episodes of a new Doctor who's a Black queer guy. And so it brings a whole new dimension. And it's, imagine that, controversial with some folks.
I can't believe that.
I know. Oh, my gosh.
No.
I think it'd be a lot of fun. Because you don't really have much of a deep background with Doctor Who, right?
Yeah. So, Mark, this is something that I'm kind of embarrassed to admit, given our show, and you know, my full embrace of nerddom is I've never seen a single episode of Doctor Who. That I should be embarrassed by that, right?
I'm surprised they let you keep your nerd card. Frankly,
I know
it should have been revoked a long time ago.
I just got an email asking me to send it back. So.
There you go. That's not a surprise. You should
but
have
I won't
admitted
have
that
to
publicly.
Because I will watch Doctor Who in the next week, and I'll be ready to talk about it.
Fantastic.
Time travel.
I think it'll be
dimension
a lot of
shifting.
Wibbly,
TARDIS flying.
TARDIS. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I always blow the line, but timey wimey. Storylines and stuff. It's going to be great. Wibbly
it's
wobbly, timey wimey, man. Yeah, I'm excited.
I'm ready for it. So I hope that if you out there listening have not watched Doctor Who and want to watch it for the first time with me, we'll be in the same boat. Or those longtime lovers of Doctor Who, this is going to be the episode for you next time. So thanks for joining us. We really appreciate all of you who tune in, and we can't wait to see you next time on the Moonshine Jesus Show.
Moonshine Jesus.